Is the Microsoft cloud, or any major vendor's cloud for that matter, like Hotel California? You can check out anytime you like, but you can never really leave? Or does it make sense for customers to look more closely at moving some or even all of their workloads out of the public cloud and back on premises? Welcome to the third episode in a new series of Directions on Microsoft podcasts, Brainstorm. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor-in-chief here at Directions, and I'm your host for this series where our analysts discuss emerging topics on Microsoft products, services, and most importantly, strategies. Brainstorm is your chance to see how the analysts at Directions on Microsoft do what they do. Twice weekly, the analysts hold scope meetings where we talk about the tech news of the week, reports we're working on, and some of the best ways to deliver the information that our customers need to know. Brainstorm is meant to give you a front row seat to one of these scope meetings. We're going to talk about cloud repatriation today, the idea of moving workloads and apps off the public cloud and back on premises for a variety of reasons, including cost, internal policies, storage needs, and better control. Companies have been debating whether repatriation has more pros than cons for the past few years. But last year, the debate was rekindled when David Heinmeier Hansson, the CTO of 37signals, which is the company behind Basecamp and the Hey email service, among others, blogged that, quote, "We have left the cloud and we've saved $1.5 million USD per year as the result." My question is, just because DHH can repatriate, can or should any customer do the same? So here is our panel today for this discussion. We have Jim Gaynor, who covers collaboration tools, Windows Server, and Azure infrastructure at Directions on Microsoft. We have Rob Sanfilippo, who covers Azure, development tools, and AI. And we have Andy Snodgrass, who covers Azure Analytics and business apps. All right, people, we're going to dive right in. Let's take our panel's pulses on the idea of repatriation. Do you think it really is feasible for customers to move workloads out of Azure or any cloud once they're embedded there? And can customers really run their own apps better than Microsoft can? Who wants to start?
Oh, everybody's going to stay away.
Everyone's like, oh, no, here come the question.
No, not me. Not this one.
Right. I'll jump. Right, I'm going to actually channel my friend Wes Miller, who's not here, and say it depends. Because in this case, it's really deeply about how you've integrated your workloads with that cloud, with Azure, AWS, whatever. If you just did a basic lift and shift when you went there in the first place, I mean, you just ran it like it was someone else's VM and storage hosting and didn't really adopt many of its stuff, then hey, it's feasible. You know, you've got lowest common denominator. You can just bring it right back. It's pretty easy to get VM hosting and stuff anywhere. But that's probably why you want to leave in the first place, because really getting the most out of cloud adoption means really embracing the architecture and service offerings and not just treating it like another colo. But if you did, then yeah, it's feasible to get out because you haven't gotten specialized. You haven't let it dig its roots into you, and you can bring it back out. There's a lot of other things about it, but you could do that. As for running your own apps, I mean, it depends upon the workloads. I'd say with very specific workloads, things you know really well, that's like David's thing, is they know their service inside and out. You know, they know all the requirements. They know everything about it. They've got lots of data about how it grows, the load it has on it, all of the growth, and it's very known and predictable. If you've got that data, then you're more likely to have a successful repatriation and be able to make some savings. But if you don't have that data, if you don't know, then you're not going to be able to make the kind of predictions that would make a repatriation viable.
Yeah, and I think 37signals, especially since they're a high-tech company, right, and they have specific processes that they know better than anyone else, then they probably have some things that make a lot of sense. I mean, you got to remember, right, when we go to the cloud, whether it's Azure or AWS, Google, anything else, there isn't a full menu of every possible technical option for you there. Okay, in Azure, it's the things that Microsoft provides. It's their families and in series of computes in their configurations that are on that, right? And right. Some of the stuff is on by default, like triple redundancy for storage. Do you need that for everything? Probably not. Okay, and so if I was 37 signals, I could take a look at all the compute resources that Azure has, and I think, you know what, those aren't exactly the ones that would be, you know, supreme for the way we were doing things. The storage isn't exactly the way that we would normally do that, and the types of replication, everything else on it. And so they may be able to configure an environment in their own data centers that is more in tune and more optimized specifically for their needs. Okay. And in the process, they could probably save some money on that. Doesn't mean every company should do it, but I could see why they would do it.
Okay.
I'm just going to come out right out and say, in most cases, it wouldn't make logistical or financial sense to revert from the cloud back to on-premises deployments. And there's many reasons for
that's
that.
That's why we're having this conversation. Perfect.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, there's many reasons why I strongly state that. I'll start by saying that, well, customer plans for moving to Azure or any cloud should have already evaluated whether it is appropriate for that customer to make that move. There's always a possibility that that evaluation was off target and the cloud doesn't fulfill its promises. But you know, customers should build contingencies into their plans that include how to measure if their migration was a success and then have a escape plan if it isn't. But migrations that are susceptible to that result should begin with test phases that reveal early on that the cloud is not the correct path. And that makes it much easier to back out than at a late stage in the migration or after all your workloads have been moved. And then, you know, look at like migration tools. So there's several offered by Microsoft that are native to Azure. Azure Migrate is the highest level tool. And it very much uses a Hotel California design. Azure Migrate provides many capabilities for moving to Azure, but none for moving out of Azure. And that's for obvious Microsoft business reasons. And it's not the only migration tool out there. There's numerous third parties that'll help you move into and out of the cloud, but that won't be a cheap path either. But, you know, just at a higher level, it mostly depends on your in-house IT skill and, of course, your budgets that'll determine whether it makes sense to stay self-hosted. So tech companies like 37 Signals tend to be the best candidate since the company is focused on building and working with hardware and software deployments. They know that internally, that's what they do. So self-hosting might even be more beneficial than the cloud to those customers because the experience helps them design and build their own products. But non-tech customers, organizations that don't focus on tech, are rarely able to justify maintaining their own data centers versus going to the cloud, except when there's limitations of the cloud that would prevent them from using it in the first place, like security or sovereignty of your data. And I also wanted to point out earlier in a discussion that, like most things in life, balance and moderation are important. All cloud or all self-hosted are not the only two choices. Hybrid deployments are typically that porridge that is just right.
Ooh, nice. The porridge. Jim, porridge. What do you have to say?
Yeah, so there's two things. One, Rob, you made a really good, you know, you made a really good point. Again, it's all about, you know, do you have the knowledge? Do you have the understanding? Do you know what's going on? There are a lot of companies that during the pandemic made this, you know, pell-mell rush to the cloud. So that was a not well planned out one. And now they're having, you know, they're having regrets. And that can either be because they didn't do the planning that you talked about that they should have done in the first place. They just, we must go to the cloud, and they did it immediately. Or, you know, it was a workload that shouldn't have gone in the first place. It wasn't well planned out. So that's really, really key. And if you're thinking now about repatriation, that should be a little bit of a red flag of like, well, did we do the right planning in the first place? And if we didn't do the right planning in the first place, are we doing the right planning now?
Yeah.
That's really important. And similarly, you mentioned having that knowledge in-house. If you've got some consultants coming to you and saying, hey, we can save you a whole lot of money via repatriation, I'd look at that really, really closely because they're more along the lines of we can make a lot of money migrating your stuff.
Yep.
Andy?
But do you think maybe there's some executive or some director who had a political or emotional stake in this game of why they originally did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, to assume that somebody's going to actually come through and do a decent analysis and come up with the right decision on things, I think is a little optimistic. I think a lot of people just do this because the executive saw it on an airplane magazine somewhere and they go, we got to be in the cloud. And then they got contacted by Microsoft and wined and dined and said, yep, we're going to the cloud. And afterwards, they get the reality of the check and say, I don't think this was a good idea.
I think that's being made much more clear by the latest AI trend, too. That's one of those that everyone's hopping onto. And maybe it's the right thing, but it is the trend. And I think companies and execs don't want to miss out on that. And it's just like what you're saying. Yeah, it was the cloud 10 years ago. Now it's AI.
I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, oh, this sounds like the AI discussion here.
Right.
And ding, we've mentioned AI. Yep.
There it is.
All right. Follow on to some of the points you guys have made, which have been all really interesting and excellent points. So it sounds like you all sort of agree that it's unlikely that an organization or most organizations would repatriate all their workloads. So the question then becomes, okay, what if only some workloads might be good candidates? How should an organization think about that? And are there typical types of workloads that you think automatically qualify as the best possible candidates for repatriation? Andy, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I can tell you what isn't.
Okay.
How about we start there? Email.
Yeah.
Yeah, please don't look at repatriating commodity activities like email. You know,
exactly.
Nowadays, I just don't think that's an intelligent move anymore. I think good candidates would probably be anything that's like a really high value workload where you've got dedicated resources that'll make it successful when it comes back. And it's really something that is of interest to the organization. You know, if it turns out to be one of these things, well, we're just going to pull it over here because we can do BI on our own and we could do data storage on our own and we think we can save money on it. Those type of things don't get a lot of attention once they come back, you know, so focus in on the high value things, or at least that's my opinion on it. Jim, what do you think?
So there's going to be some things too that you simply can't because of how they're offered, whether that's something that's technical in the service that's offered, or it's an integrated service that's offered, or even, you know, as Microsoft tends to do, licensing. I mean, Azure Virtual Desktop is a good example. Yes, you can run remote desktop services, you can run your own local VDI farm, but there are several capabilities that are exclusive to Azure Virtual Desktop that you don't get if you're doing RDS. There's things like, you know, RDP short path, which can improve your network performance. You get that in AVD, you don't get that in RDS. The multi-session versions of Windows 10 and Windows 11 that can really help reduce the resource consumption. You can't get those if you're running your own VDI. There are a lot of things like that that you need to look at. Like, yes, can you do an 80% solution on premises? Yes, but there's definitely things, Hotel California things, where they say, hey, you can get that here, but you can't get it if you're running it at home.
Yeah, I'm thinking about particular Azure workloads, and there's many ways you can progress your way through Azure. You typically look at lift and shift in the beginning, and then you might get into PaaS services. But lift and shift migrations will be the easiest to revert, since a lift and shift move to Azure or any cloud, it's the simplest type of deployment to just lift and shift it back to on-premises. And these are usually VMs with applications and configurations that don't require extensive reworking, redesigning, rewriting new code, depending on where they're deployed. But even just doing a lift and shift, it's not just a copy paste or a cut paste. You have to modify endpoints, connection strings, and you have to configure cloud elements like virtual networks when you move into the cloud. But
underlying,
I would still classify them. What's that?
Underlying storage.
Right. Yeah. All that supporting stuff that goes around a VM. Sometimes, I've thought of it, it's not lift and shift, but lift, shift, and fix is more of the way to describe it, because it's not just those two steps. But that is still, I would say, the easiest thing relatively to repatriate out of the cloud. If you've kept it in that form, you've lifted, now you want to go lift it back. if you've done it, if you've gone further and taken more dependencies on the cloud using PaaS services, for example, now it's going to be harder to repatriate those.
Yeah. So that's a good segue into a question that people should be asking themselves if they are really determined to repatriate. What are the risks? Obviously, there's going to be financial risks, but what else are some of the risks that people say, okay, you know what? I have a workload. I think I can run it better than Microsoft can. What should they be leery of before they do this? Jim?
So first off, I want to mention something when Rob Sanfilippo was saying, you know, lift okay. and shift and fix. I'm like, I was listening to Daft Punk's Technologic on the way into work. So I'm like, lift it, shift it, fix it, break it. one of the risks.
Well, wait a minute. He already came up with the you know, the right porridge, and now he's got this one. That's like two.
I got a whole list here. Yeah.
He's doing good. And yes, this is what happens in scope meetings. One of the other risks. I mean, yeah, financial was one of those first things on there because it's. I mean, when you bring stuff back in, there's a whole, you're going from OpEx back to CapEx. You've got to buy all your servers, you've got to buy all that hardware, and you're locking yourself in because, you know, in a typical corporate environment, you buy all of that and it's going to depreciate over 3 or 5 years, and you know, if you change your mind 18 months in, hey, you still own all those servers, that's a sunk cost. But there's also the technical risk. We've talked a lot about you need to have the in-house knowledge to do all of this, and let's be honest, it's easier for Microsoft to hire people who are experts in virtualization, containerization, security, networking than it is for you. They, you know, they can throw more money at them, have better benefits, better career path. And so if you bring those in-house, you've got to have that in-house because, you know, if you're farming it out to consultants, is it really any better there? So you need to worry about staffing and maintaining that staff. And even with a smaller pool of staff, knowledge tends to adhere more in people than in the systems. And so the inevitable turnover will happen and you've got to worry about knowledge transfer. So having that in-house knowledge and expertise does become a risk. You've got to have it and you've got to maintain it and keep those people or work on knowledge transfer as they move around. And that's a risk that I think a lot of companies don't take into account.
You know, Jim, I think you're right on it. And one of them that was coming up with me is I've lived in some small towns, mm-hmm. cities, small cities, right? And, you know, the knowledge that you laid off those data center people 3, 4, 5 years ago, you know, and a whole crew of them when you went to the cloud and you got rid of a bunch of these, the people that were managing your stuff on a daily basis, they're not going to come back. You know, they've already found other jobs. And so you don't have that institutional knowledge that you used to have. And so the people you wind up hiring for your own data center, for your own infrastructure management and everything else going on there, they're going to be new to your organization for the most part. Either that or there'll be somebody that you already have that you're moving over to take over some kind of new workload on it. And there's risks there of not having that knowledge. And, yeah. You know, when we used to have data centers of our own, you could grow people, you could educate people, you could run them through their apprenticeship or whatever program you had and make them into a data center person that could manage this thing intelligently. And they knew where it was and they knew who to ask help for. You don't have that anymore. So you're going to stand this all up new. And that's a bit scary. That's a real risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I think about the risk of this repatriation, I'm thinking about sustainability. Like maybe you could do it. It was easier to do 5 years ago. It was even easier to do 10 years ago, but it's getting harder as the industry is just almost becoming pure cloud focused. So you look at on-premises applications like Microsoft's Exchange and SharePoint, and they're withering. The on-premises versions are withering away as the company is focused almost entirely on the cloud. So even if a customer is capable of self-hosting, they have the skills and experience, that software may not be there for them. And even if it works today, it might not be available for much longer. We don't know how many new versions of the on-premises applications are coming out of Microsoft. We always wonder every time they release one, is this the last one? Mm-hmm. So you think, well, how wasteful? Maybe you could do your repatriation today and you could make a justification and prove that it works. But you go to the cloud. Now you've gone to the cloud. Now you've come out of the cloud and now you realize, wait, can't stay here much longer. Now you got to go back to the cloud. So all that flip-flopping, that's going to be really expensive and not something you want to go a path you want to go down.
Well, that kind of gets back to that whole thing of what's a good candidate then, isn't it? Is you have to really look at the stuff you're planning to bring back and say, is this something that's going to be supported? You know, if it's a Windows Server related activity, if it's SQL Server related, and those look like they've got good 10-year runways in front of them at least, then that might make sense. But if it's SharePoint, if it's Exchange, yeah, I'd be really careful on that.
Yeah, we're rolling back around to knowable and predictable. You've got to have the data, both what it's been and then what it will be. Do the things, the pillars that you're resting your workload on, will those continue to exist on premises?
Mm, right. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the actual infrastructure. So somebody is thinking about repatriation. Do they need to think about things like containers and Kubernetes? You know, things have changed so much in the past few years, like you guys are talking about. So what operating systems and databases should they even be looking at, or should they just transfer to a different and hopefully better, quote unquote, cloud service provider?
I
know, there's so many things
to think about.
Jim
has to go in on that.
He does.
Yeah.
He said Kubernetes. You got to take it.
I did.
I know, he said containers. So in theory, and we'll get into practice in a minute here, Kubernetes and containerization in theory bring the same kind of benefits that VMs did 15 years ago. You've got the workloads are more portable, it's easier to move between providers, there's, you know, computing foundation, standardized Kubernetes, and when we talk about OS, at least if you're using Linux-based containers, which, let's be honest, that's the vast majority of container-based workloads is Linux. So if you've got that, then in theory, yes, you could take your container-based workload and bring it into an on-premises Kubernetes deployment, into another cloud's Kubernetes-based deployment. They're all standards-based, right? It's all easy, right? Right. In reality, there aren't that many organizations on-premises or in the cloud that are using Kubernetes without some kind of additional service layer on top of it, even Google, because as people have found out, Kubernetes can be hideously complex to configure and manage. The care and feeding is non-trivial. So maybe you can move your containers to another standards-based Kubernetes service, but Azure Kubernetes Service isn't Amazon Elastic Kubernetes Service, isn't the Kubernetes management service that you might purchase and deploy on-premises to simplify your Kubernetes. So the workloads move, but we're back to knowledge. It's a whole new set of management tooling that needs to be learned and re-optimized and configured so that your workload can go. There's all of the stuff around it. You can say, oh yeah, I can move my containers, but all the different stuff around it, and it's standard Kubernetes, but it's not. And the vendors are trying to differentiate themselves by their offering, but those differentiated offerings also make it harder to move. And I didn't touch on databases, and I didn't touch on some other things. There's the laughter. Go for it.
I was thinking about that. You know, that's a really interesting point is with your Azure services, you're going to be on the latest and greatest that Microsoft wants you to have, right? And so if you have databases that are an Azure SQL database, then that means bringing it back is going to be on SQL Server 2022. Okay. Likewise, if you're running Postgres or MySQL, Mongo, or Cassandra, then you're going to be on the latest versions of those as well, because Microsoft only supports the absolute latest in those realms. And so you got to be up to date with those. But the other thing that was interesting on that, especially if you're talking Azure SQL or Postgres or MySQL, is there's a lot of internal analysis and internal features that they have in those services for security and for intrusion detection and everything else that are all tied in, that are all part of that service. And you're going to have to implement those type of controls on your own when you get back. And so it's not just a matter of comparing the cost of Azure SQL database to SQL Server on-prem. You got to look at all the other things that go along with the Azure SQL database service and say, am I going to have the same standard? And if I am, I have to then instantiate these different services to go along with my SQL Server on-prem. So it's a big item out there that's different than before.
I am going to take a quick break right now. I want to mention co-pilots, you know, because we just don't hear enough about them from Microsoft these days. Just kidding. At Directions, we have realized that our customers, and we analysts ourselves, need help tracking the constantly growing family of Microsoft Copilots. Names keep changing, licensing and pricing keeps changing, new Copilots are appearing regularly, it sometimes feels like daily. So we at Directions created a chart that pulls together all the basic facts for more than 30 business-focused Copilots from Microsoft. The chart gives you an at-a-glance understanding of each Copilot. It details use scenarios, training and customer data that is used, licensing costs when known, and other dependencies on other Microsoft products. If you're a Directions member, you already can access this chart, which we are updating regularly. If you're not yet a member, you still can get a free copy of this cheat sheet just by going to directionsonmicrosoft.com/Microsoft-Copilots. We also have a blog, a podcast, as you know, if you're listening to this, and lots more information on all things Microsoft licensing and tech related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. So check it out. Okay, back to the panel. Especially after an Azure outage, more than a few admins take to Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it these days, and they wonder aloud whether they could do it better in terms of reliability, scalability, administration. So my question for you all is that the right question? And can they actually do it better than Microsoft potentially? Rob, would you like to start?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about the Monday morning quarterbacks.
Exactly.
They're looking in their rearview mirror and they're saying, oh, I could have done better there.
That's number three, Rob. You did three of them.
Oh, gee. Okay. You got to have three.
Do we need a bell? Do we need a bell?
Well, okay. So it's not impossible that they could do it better. As you point out, 37 signals claims they have. Mm-hmm. I think that better, in quotes, is likely only to come after extensive planning by experienced IT staff with robust budgets. And again, it might work at first, but not be sustainable, meaning it might not continue to meet requirements. It could also cause the customer to miss out on future innovations that can only be delivered by major cloud vendors like unlimited scalability and AI. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Jim?
I agree. That's when we were talking about this offline. I'm like, yeah, it's total quarterbacking going on. Mm-hmm. I think the answer is no. They couldn't do better and maintain the same breadth of options and flexibility you get in the cloud. Could it be better? Could they do better? I mean, Microsoft's getting raked over the coals for some of their security practices. So, hell yeah, they could be better. Could some of the commentators online who specialize in a specific area do things better in that narrowly focused area? And probably, but across the entire estate, I still think it's a no. You have that breadth and range can't be reproduced in a smaller on-premises organization, and that's one of the challenges with the Monday morning quarterbacking. And I agree with you entirely on when you can do it on-premises, it's with planning and budget and everything else. I remember talking, going to a conference once, and they were talking about a major. This is some of my Mac background. They were talking about the change from Mac OS 9 to the Mac OS 10. I'm dating myself here, and Pixar was up giving their discussion about it. Like, oh yeah, it's easy. We just had this massive plan that had 18 months of planning and total backing of all of the executives and a huge budget to write all of our custom scripts. It was easy.
And so, I find with enough money, just about anything is easy.
Time right? and money. Easier. There you go.
Yeah.
It's all right. Relative.
Well, yeah, relatively easier. And I think that's the true with this one as well, Jim. I think you're right. Is if you have the ability, if you have the resources and if you have the money and the time, could you do it as well as Microsoft? Yeah, but I, from my background, which were with a bunch of low margin industries, we never had enough budget, never had enough resources, and going to the cloud was always a good idea because they could do it better than we could. Not necessarily that they could do it better than we could do it, it's just that they had more resources and money to do it better than we were able to with our constraints, you know?
Well, Jim brought up the security topic, so let's do it. Microsoft's been in the news lately quite a bit for all their foibles in the security area, but they still have a lot more resources dedicated to securing Azure than individual companies probably ever could have, right? So is security a factor that companies should consider when they're thinking about repatriation and whether that makes sense for their org?
Yeah, well, I'll go ahead.
Okay.
I think one view is that Microsoft has these major resources, but they're spread out over thousands of tenants.
Right.
But, and you think of, from the customer point of view, a single customer only has to secure its own apps and users. So in some cases, security problems that Microsoft misses wouldn't be missed by a customer focusing only on its own much smaller number of vulnerability points. Mm-hmm. But I think it's easier to defend the view that Microsoft has top experts that know what to look for. They have the tools and procedures for handling attacks. They understand and have, you know, low-level access to infrastructure software. And they have access to the product teams in most cases that have built these products. So they can always tap those teams mm-hmm. during emergencies and get the feedback directly from the people that created the technology. So that, I think, that second view that Microsoft is more capable at doing the security role is probably the more realistic view.
Mm. Jim?
So I'm going to channel another one of my colleagues, and that's Michael Cherry. what Microsoft also has access to that you probably don't is legal experts that deeply understand the regulatory landscape. They have access to vast quantities of insurance and insurance experts. If you're hosting those things on premises, and let's say you've got customer data, does your legal team have intimate knowledge of how that customer data needs to be secured, how you need to notify customers in case of a breach, what your responsibilities are, and can your organization on their own afford the cyber insurance, although I hate using the word cyber for anything, can you afford the insurance that you should have on those operations in case something does go wrong? Microsoft's got that. Do you?
Right.
That's a huge hurdle to face, especially in an organization that's not a technical organization, and like the ones that Andy and I have been in, where IT is considered, oh, that's just overhead. That's not part of what actually makes us money. If that's the kind of IT organization you've got, it's even less likely you've got those resources available.
Very true. Good point. All right. I have to ask a Copilot question. There's no discussion that cannot have a Copilot question in it. So if you're thinking about repatriation, and you're already starting to use some AI services from Microsoft, like LLM, generative services, ChatGPT, that kind of thing. If you go out on your own and leave Microsoft's cloud, what happens? Like, is that something that's going to be a problem for you if you repatriate? Andy?
Well, all right. So initially I said we shouldn't move Office back on-prem, you shouldn't move email and the rest of that. And a lot of those things are tied in with a lot of the Copilot stuff that people want to use, you know, the Microsoft 365 Copilot. And so if you keep those, then you still got Copilot-y stuff. If you keep Dynamics, you still got Copilot-y stuff, right? And mm-hmm. if you're coming out of Azure, then do you really care that you have Copilot for Azure? You know, so it's one of these things where I think in the Copilot realm, this is Microsoft specific AI related stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, the general idea of, you know, generative AI services, ChatGPT and the rest of that, there's a lot of these things that are emerging in the market right now. And if your organization really needs generative AI capabilities, Microsoft's not the only play. And so bringing it back on-prem, if you're big enough, you could probably have some kind of AI on-prem that could do these mm-hmm. type of things. If not, there are plenty of services out there you can subscribe to and get that same capability or similar to it that'll you can tailor for your specific needs on-prem. So is this something that I would say is a stopper from keeping me from repatriating from Microsoft? Probably not. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some good stuff in there, but keep that stuff if that doesn't make sense to come back on-prem, you know?
All right. Okay. Rob?
Yeah, I go back to I mentioned hybrid deployments before, and you don't have to be all in or all out of the cloud. Hybrid it's the best in so many cases. We were just talking to customers that are starting to use GitHub Copilot Enterprise version, and that's where the Copilot actually trains on your own code repositories and your documentation around your code. So it's more apt to help out your developers because it knows all of your code. And when you use that level of GitHub Copilot, the enterprise version, you have to use GitHub Enterprise Cloud as well, which means you have to connect to the cloud version of GitHub. Whereas before you might have only used the on-premises version. Yes, there is an on-premises version of GitHub. Mm-hmm. It's called GitHub Enterprise Server. You can host that yourself. So we've talked to customers already that were doing self-hosting, or maybe they weren't using GitHub at all. And now they want to use the Copilot, but they're realizing, oh, well, we have to connect to that cloud service where we haven't had to do that before. Is this a bad thing? So it's not necessarily a bad thing. That's just one little piece of the cloud that you're connecting into. And as long as you can secure it properly, you know, what are the, it's not like a tragic downside that you have to tap into some of the cloud, even if you want to remain largely on premises for everything else.
Okay. Good point. Jim?
I got one little thing to add in. And so
sure.
Rob's entirely right. Angie's entirely right. This is the edge case for your really ambitious. You've got a really ambitious CIO or CTO or even someone in the C-suite. We can do it all ourselves. Microsoft, Amazon, Google have access to hardware that you simply don't have. You're not going to get the same. I mean, it's almost impossible to get the kind of GPUs and hardware to run AI right now. NVIDIA's raking in money with access to the A100, B100 GPUs, and you're not going to get that. So whereas in Azure, I mean, let's say you want to do a relatively strong roll your own LLM or model, you can still get VMs that do that. You can get those through Azure, but you're not going to get those for yourself in your own data center unless you're immense on their scale.
Right.
And that's not even to mention new proprietary hardware, like the Microsoft has these Maya chips now that are designed specifically for AI. Those are only inside Microsoft data center. You can't go out there and buy them on the commercial market. So the only way you'll be able to even get that advantage is to be a subscriber to Microsoft services.
All right. All good points. I'm going to take one more quick break before we go to our customer question and our hot button segments of the show. So my question for you is, have you attended, either in person or virtually, one of the Directions on Microsoft Licensing bootcamps? If you haven't, you have a golden opportunity in May 21st to May 23rd, to be precise, in Atlanta. That's where the next in-person bootcamp is. I went to the Atlanta bootcamp last year, and I really have to say, I did feel like the quantity and quality of information was impressive, almost overwhelming. The opportunity to talk with the directions analysts and other customers there really made it feel like people appreciated the event. It is the place to update and ensure your knowledge about Microsoft licensing is current. We also have virtual boot camps throughout the year, plus another in-person boot camp in September in Bellevue, Washington, right near Microsoft. Go to directionsonmicrosoft.com or email info@directionsonmicrosoft.com to learn more about the boot camps, the EA advisory, and other services that we offer. All right, we're moving to the customer questions segment now. So we get a lot of customer questions at Directions on Microsoft through various channels. And we're going to talk about one question that we recently received without divulging any customer names or locations. We're just going to present the question and have our analysts talk about what they would advise the customer to do in this case. So this is a question about Azure Hybrid Benefit. The customer said, I've been using Azure Hybrid Benefit with some existing server licenses for Azure workloads. When I repatriate, can I revert those licenses to on-premises workloads without a penalty? Or are there any issues I need to watch out for? Who would like to start?
Well, so obviously we had to look at these questions in advance. So I asked our expert on this, Wes Miller, about this particular situation. And he brought up an interesting one. He said, suppose you, a few years ago, you were moving to Azure, and let's say you had 100 servers, all right, on-prem. Mm-hmm. They were all running Windows Data Center, and just for ease of use, they all had the same core count, all right, make this easy. Mm-hmm. And suppose you moved half of them to Azure. So that means for those 50 licenses, you were able to drop software assurance and save money. And the reason you could do that is because Windows Server running data center with active software assurance has concurrent use rights, where you can run it on a server on-prem, but you can also use the Azure hybrid benefits to reduce your cost in Azure. It's been a really nice feature that's been around for a number of years now. And so you could get away with only having software assurance on 50 of your licenses that would cover your on-prem, as well as those 50 you moved into Azure. Now, you still own those original 50 licenses that you dropped software assurance on, but if you're moving those servers back, those Windows server environments back on-prem and repatriating them, then you're going to need to come up to the latest version. You're going to need to get those licenses with software assurance on them. In some cases, you might have to rebuy those licenses in order to get software assurance. And so we want to make sure that people realize there's this cost analysis that you did, you know, that Sanfilippo talked about, where you went to Azure to begin with, and it made a lot of sense. And not everyone realizes that when they come back, they're going to have to re-up those licenses that they put on the table or on a shelf somewhere and get those working properly for you again when you bring all those servers back. So it could be more of an effort and more of a cost than you originally planned in the analysis. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason you can't bring them back. That's perfectly fine. But be careful with the way you're handling software assurance.
Okay. Yeah, that's... Because, the short answer is, if you have the licenses and you've had software assurance on them, yes, you can transfer them back. And then, you know, your Microsoft licenses under SA can be transferred once every 90 days. You can move them around. Mm-hmm. Now, Andy talked about data center. There's also standards. So if you're using standard core licenses, those don't have the dual use. So those you can move. You can move those to Azure, and you can move them back, but there's no dual use. You can't use them both on-prem and in the cloud. And again, they can only be transferred at once every 90 days. But there's one fun trick to know about standard that might actually end up catching you up, is when you move your standard cores to Azure, you get one occurrence of a 180-day grace period where you can do dual use. You can run those standard cores both in your data center and in Azure as part of moving to Azure. And you might be thinking, well, hey, cool, that's great. I'll have those 180 days to move back. Well, you don't, because that's a one-time thing, and you probably burned that when you moved to Azure. Mm-hmm. So coming back, you've got to worry about, like, oh, am I going to be properly licensed for my migration back with, you know, any kind of overlap period and such. Microsoft is probably not going to be as forgiving if you're leaving their cloud as they would be when you're going into it.
Probably not. Okay, let's do our last segment, which is something we call hot buttons. So we go around in the scope meetings and we talk about what people are working on, what they're into right now in the world of Microsoft, what's catching their eye, or what are they digging deeper into. And I'll tell you guys what mine is first. I am going to get to go to Build this year. The press hasn't been allowed to go to Build since 2019. And so I've been like getting all my ducks in a row, doing my sessions. I'm so excited. First big show I'm going to go to since the pandemic. So woohoo.
It's the merch, isn't it? You're going
it
for the
is.
Merch.
I only want the swag. That's the only reason I really go to these things. But
T-shirt. Yep.
I almost put on my Build 2018 T-shirt today. I didn't.
Aw. But what about you guys? What are you working on, or what are you interested in right now? What's catching your eye?
Well, I got one. my hot button is Microsoft Fabric. One, why did they name this thing Fabric? Because Fabric is a back-end technology, and what they're talking about here is this is all front-end related stuff. Is data and analytics. It really bugs me, the name. Anyway, I won't get into that, although it is a hot button. What I've got is, with Fabric, they're positioning it like it's going to take over the world. You know, it's grabbed almost all of Synapse Analytics and Data Explorer, and now it's taken over all of Power BI. And they just announced, Microsoft just announced, that by July 1st, the only way you'll be able to buy a high-end Power BI capacity is if you buy it through Fabric. And so they're forcing people to go from Power BI into Fabric through licensing. And I'd hate to say it. I think that's a terrible thing to do, but that's fine. Okay.
I guess that's a way to force people to move over to Fabric, right?
Do I sound a little wound up on it?
You do sound a little wound up, but I get it. What about you, Rob?
Yeah. Here's a thing that came up in the last couple of weeks. And first, I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not a lawyer, but we have at least one other person we work with who is very much a lawyer. And so he gets into this stuff. But looking at co-pilots, we found an interesting thing that wasn't told to us, but was found by doing some sleuthing. And there's one co-pilot in particular, Microsoft Co-pilot. If that's what it's named now. That used to be Bing Chat Enterprise. But that's the one that's free that anyone gets, consumer or organizational. And then there's a couple of different tiers of it. There's this one that has commercial data protection that can protect your data. So that's what you would, the version of it you would use from inside of an organization. Anyway, that Copilot, Microsoft Copilot, if you look at its terms of use, it asks the user to have the agreement, the terms of use are an agreement between the user, the one end user, and Microsoft. Versus every other Copilot, including Copilot for Microsoft 365, the terms of the agreement are between the company and Microsoft.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, you know, I'm again not a lawyer, but that could have implications for users within companies that are using Microsoft Copilot with commercial data protection. So they've logged on with their Entra ID worker school account, and they've agreed to these terms, which mean that they, as the employee, are the ones that would have to go to court if something they do with that Copilot leads to a legal suit, versus having that onus be placed on their organization. So that means as a worker in a company, you could be legally responsible for things you do while you're doing your job. And so we've had a couple customers that are really wondering about this and a little bit taking some pause in adopting Copilot to really understand that and talk to their own lawyers and figure out what this means. So we're still processing this too. And I think Michael Cherry is going to have a blog post out on this pretty soon, but we're looking at it. And it's interesting because, again, there's, I don't know, a dozen or 17 co-pilots now, something like that. And we have that list. You should go look at the list. But all of those co-pilots are, the terms are between the company and Microsoft, whereas this one co-pilot, which actually is probably the most popular because it's used by mainstream public, is between the user and Microsoft. So that's the hot button I wanted to mention.
That is hot. That's very hot and very worrying.
Frighteningly hot.
Jim, what about you?
Okay. So I'm actually a hot button. I just kind of finished. So I'm going to promoting. I just did a report on this one. What everybody heard about, announced on the absolute worst day possible on April 1st, April Fool's Day, Microsoft announced the unbundling of Teams. So, you hear about that, like they did it in the European Economic Area plus Switzerland, where Teams is no longer included in Office 365 and Microsoft 365 Enterprise. And people are like, well, wait, what the heck does this mean for us? And it's hot because you think it's going to impact all of you, right? Like, oh, because you now, this thing, if you buy the unbundled thing, the Office 365, Microsoft 365, E3, E5, without Teams, then if you need Teams stuff, you've got to buy Teams separately. And guess what? If you buy them separately, it turns out to be $3 per user per month, US, for each user, because it reduces the cost by $225 per user, but it costs $525 to get it. Mm-hmm. But what makes it a hot button isn't this per se, because all of that stuff I just mentioned only applies to what they're calling net new people. And Mary Jo, you and I worked together on the blog post about this. I've just done a report on this one for our subscribers. Net new means you've got no Office 365 subscriptions or Microsoft 365 subscriptions in your organization at all. And really, let's be honest, how many of our readers work for organizations, how many of our listeners work for organizations that have none? Mm-hmm. Very few. But in those scenarios, yeah, you can't get Teams anymore. But for existing customers, if you're an existing customer, you can still get the Office 365, Microsoft 365 suites that you know. You can still buy Enterprise E3 with Teams. You can still buy Enterprise E5 with Teams. You can still buy, and also the frontline suites, which are less used than the Enterprise suites, the frontline suites still include Teams or not Teams as you choose, regardless of whether you knew or not. So this becomes a big announcement, but for customers, it doesn't impact a lot. What it is, and this is what we've hypothesized about, is it's Microsoft responding to regulators, and you have to wonder, like, okay, so what memo, what news did Microsoft get sometime in March that caused them to release a PR, release information about changes to a product that they've been hyping? I mean, they were all on the Teams bandwagon until they became the Copilot company on April Fool's Day. That's not a good day to announce anything. So while, you know, we've deciphered this and it's, you know, we've got a report on it and it's working through our licensing stuff. So it'll be in our licensing reference set as well. We'll have that all updated. It'll be in the new boot camps. The bigger question and what's still kind of fascinating is what's going on in the background? What's going on underneath those waters that's causing this to happen? And what else is going to happen? Wes Miller thinks we're going to see price increases in the future so that it'll be, you know, all the prices will be the same again. But there's stuff moving under there. And Andy's chomping at the bit for something. Andy, I know. What do you got, Andy?
Jim, since they're unbundling Teams, does that mean that they're going to make the new Teams work properly?
Ooh, ouch. Did the old one work properly?
Zing. I know the old one did. I just want the new one to work. I like the new one. I do. Yeah. I think it's got some nice features. And I just,
it's got some a few problems.
The crazy thing is, you know, I hate to be that person, but it works for me. But, you know, again, just because there's so many reports out there, both from you guys, you know, we've got one colleague who just has endemic problems with it. Other people online, it's like, yeah, it's Teams became this thing. It got popular initially, and then they started doing more telephony stuff into it, and then the pandemic hit, and boom, it exploded.
Yeah.
And they piled everything into it. Everybody needed Teams because everybody's working remotely, and we're going to make it the hub for collaboration. There was a whole, you know, Teams is our platform. It's not just a collaboration thing. It's the platform to build other applications on top of. Heck, it's, if you're using Dynamics, if you're even using Copilot, in a lot of ways, there's Teams apps that they're trying to make their primary interface. And so they loaded so much into this that, you know, it's become much more complicated than like, hey, I've just got my app for video conferences.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's a situation where they were making such a push to web-based apps that when they came out with this desktop Teams app, they had lost all the good people?
That's a good question. I obviously don't have an answer for that one, but they were really focused on, you know, when they first came out with Teams, like it was so Electron app, right? It's one of those, you know, it's the modern Flash. here's this framework that doesn't do any one thing well other than be cross-platform, and that it does cross-platform well, but everything else it does 80% well.
Kind of like the new Outlook, guys. Just saying.
You know what's funny is I like the new Outlook. The new Outlook's not an issue with me. It's just like everyone here, right? We've got multiple machines. So I've got a Windows 11 machine here and a Mac machine right next to it. I just want the thing to work the same on both. You know, one's a desktop, the other's a laptop. I'd like them to be the same so I could use them anywhere.
Are we going to talk about Word comments? Oh, God.
Oh, we use Word, still get into that.
For our listeners, we use commenting and markup and tracking and outline mode extensively in our workflow. And
outline mode is the big one there. We're the only customer that uses that. If you're out there using outline mode, please write into us. We'd like to hear about that.
And Microsoft, if you're listening, please pay some attention to outline mode, but in a good way, not in the way where you pay attention to it and it gets worse.
I thought they were getting rid of outline mode. Am I wrong?
It's not in the web version.
Been hearing that for at least 15 years, but it's still there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And again, for our listeners, this is typically how scope meetings go. We get off topic.
No, just yesterday I was doing a review with Rob Horowitz and he's like, use outline mode. I'm like, Rob, I use Notepad, man. Like, this is just not my wheelhouse.
Come on, this is you are the Mary Jo Foley. It's Notepad or nothing. I mean, come on.
Hey, Notepad's getting upgrades, right? Notepad's getting all kinds of new features, including spell check. I'm like, okay.
Is there a Copilot for Notepad yet?
There is a Copilot for Notepad. Yeah, there is.
Okay. For OneNote too, coming up.
Okay.
Good.
No product will escape the Copilot. Copiloting from Microsoft. Yeah.
Okay, so the next question we have to ask is where we're going for lunch, because that always seems to be the way.
Sadly, none of us are in the same city, except maybe Jim and Rob are.
But yeah, that would be us.
Yeah. Anyway, guys, thank you so much. That was really fun, and I appreciate you all taking the time to do another one of our brainstorms today.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Yep.
Yeah, thank
you.
Take
care.
It's good.
All right. I would like to remind our listeners that they can find a lot more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. Thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics you would like to hear the Directions Analysts cover in one of these kinds of podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me via Twitter or X at Mary Jo Foley. We at Directions have converged our existing Twitter/X channels into a new single platform. So if you'd like to, please give us a follow at Directions MSFT for all the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information. Thank you again.